Chapter 31, Bit to Me by Willie Snow Etheridge, The Ups and Downs of the Alps. At 4:30 in the morning, we got up to leave Salzburg. It was Norbert and Bill's brilliant idea. They felt they had to get to Geneva by Friday noon, and this was Thursday. Still groggy with sleep, we climbed down the 3 flights of stairs of the hotel and asked for our bills. They were cents each. A sum so ridiculously small ordered me not to let it pass my lips. He said it might get back to Arthur Sulzberg of the Times, and never again would Mr. Sulzberg be able to understand the big figures in Bill's expense accounts. But I have a feeling Mr. Sulzberg understands them perfectly, and the cost of this one night won't change his opinion of them too much. After all, Bill doesn't get to spend every night in an army-run hotel, which makes only a service charge. Nor, unfortunately, do I. It was basement dark and cold when we started off in the Pontiac, and there was something swishing furiously against the windshield. Curiously, it looked very much like snow, but it couldn't be here in the middle of April. We had enjoyed too many weeks of picnicking in the sun. It must be unusually big rain. Perhaps that was the way rain came in Austria. But a few minutes later, when we turned on the radio and got Munich, we heard it was snow. Immediately, I pulled my top coat over my suit more closely around me. Shortly out of Salzburg, we went into that fist of Germany that shoves down into Austria, but it was still too dark to see anything. A shivering GI raised the roadblock to let us in, and another shivering GI raised it some miles further on to let us out. We asked the second soldier if he could spare 3 cups of coffee for a dime, and he answered, "No, we are very short of rations here." How come, we wondered? Soldiers of Uncle Sam were short of rations. Having had no food since early the evening before, when we had dined at the magnificent United States Army Hotel in the village of Berchtesgaden, we decided to have a breakfast of K-rations as we drove along. Now, I assure you, there is nothing messier in a car. Norbert opened 1 can of egg yolk and pork and 1 of beef, and I smeared the contents onto the dry biscuits and fed them to him and Bill like a mama bird feeding her young. At that cold hour of the morning, the biscuits grew bigger and bigger in our throats, and we were finally forced to wash them down with 1 lone bottle of Coca-Cola that had been left over from some more affluent day. As it became light, the scenery was, "Oh well, wonderful. I have said it and I stick to it. Wonderful." Mountains piled up so high into the sky that they got all mixed up with the clouds. The weather cleared around sunrise, and though for a good while we couldn't find the sun itself because of the screening mountains, we could see now and then the bright gold slides that it threw high on the sides of faraway peaks when it slipped through open passes. Below these spotlighted peaks were many scarfs of mist that hid large sections of the mountains, but I did not mind. Somehow they made the scene more mysterious, more exciting, more alluring. I tried to explain this feeling I had for mist to my 2 companions, but met a stony silence. Goaded by their unresponsiveness, I asked them point blank, "Do you or do you not like mist?" "Well, it depends on whether I want to see the scenery or whether I want to see mist," Norbert replied ponderously. "If I'm going through country I have seen many times before, well then, mist might add charm, give it a new look. But if I've never seen the country before, then I prefer it without mist." "But not I. This morning, soft with flimsy veils and faraway sunlight, was perfect, and this Tyrolean area of Austria was, as the young say, out of this world." Yet remembering my downfall of the day before, I tried to contain myself, but I must not have tried hard enough, for suddenly Bill turned on me and yelled, "For God's sake, sake, relax. Then he suggested that I change some kilometers into miles. This was an accomplishment I learned back in Yugoslavia, and I'm inordinately proud of it, as Bill will manage it. Divide them by two. 80 kilometers, for instance, divided by two is 40. You tuck in one side of your mind, one untouched 40, and then you divide the other 40 by 4. 40 divided by 4 is 10. Well, then you add this 10 to your untouched 40, and you get 50. That, amazingly enough, is the number of miles in 80 kilometers. At every instant, at every distance in this part, as every distance in this part of Europe through which we traveled is given in kilometers, I'm pleased I've mastered the intricate mathematics of it. But naturally, I don't care to have my talent taken advantage of, especially when it is a ruse to shut me up. But I did stay shut up almost to Innsbruck, and then a peach tree in full bloom, flattened like a vine against a white stucco wall, set me off. And after that, the green swirling inn, ruffled with froth, and after that, the mighty mass of mountains that ram and push back the line of sky above Innsbruck. From Innsbruck, we climbed steadily into the Alps. We were headed for the Arlberg Pass, through which we hoped to cross the range that crowds that western corner of Austria. The lower slopes of the mountains began to be snow-covered now, like their steepled heights, and the tall black-green firs were powdered white. Bill grew worried. It looks to me as if they had fresh snow in these mountains last night. We agreed. I hope to God it hasn't gotten too deep in the pass for us to get through. We didn't think it had, and went back to admiring the scenery. At the little resort town of St. Anton, where evidently people come from far and wide to ski, the snow was several feet deep and spotlessly white. Many young people were setting out from a chalet, their skis slung across their shoulders. "It looks just like the pictures I've seen in the movies," I cried delightedly. 100 yards or so beyond the chalet, the highway was abruptly deep in snow. "We had made the wrong turning," was our first thought. Certainly, this narrow road buried in snow couldn't be the Arlberg Pass. No car could get through it. Norbert studied the map. "It was the road," he said. "There was no other." "Just keep going," he advised Bill in a man fashion. "Just go right ahead. Don't stop." Bill stared right ahead. He went about 2 feet and came to a dead halt. The wheels refused to turn another turn. Snow was crowding in from the steep banks. It was shoving up from the highway. "That I should live so long," Bill mourned. "Better back out," advised Norbert. "I'm the worst little backer in the world." "Well, you'd better try to get it anyway before we really get stuck." He tried, and we made it. But what to do now? There we were on top of the world, and no way that we could see to get down to the other side. The Arlberg Pass was the only pass on the map through those Alps. Both men looked sunk. They saw their deadline of Geneva by Friday fading fast. Bill got out of the car to make some inquiries of a skier passing by, but Norbert continued to sit, his mouth pressed into a thin, bitter line. "Oh, don't be so unhappy," I said blithely, much too blithely, I suppose. "There's no need to cry over what you can't help." "Oh, God," he exploded, "chat, chat, chat." I ducked. The skier told us to go back to St. Anton and catch a train. At least, that's the interpretation Bill put on his German. But how could we catch a train and leave the car in the far western corner of Austria? At St. Anton, we made new inquiries of a new skier. Yes, we had to catch a train. The pass was definitely closed, and when that happened, there was no way to get through except by train. "When does the train go?" asked Bill. "That's what I don't know," answered the skier. "Maybe today or maybe tomorrow." Bill and Norbert let out expletives that don't do to print. I kept my mouth shut. I don't like to be insulted twice in one day. We drove to the station, and Bill went in to see what information he could get. He returned beaming. The train was going to run in about half an hour, and there would be a flat car on it for the Pontiac, and we could sit in the Pontiac. Bill had bought a ticket for the car and for us for 10 pfennigs, about 2.5 cents. He didn't understand it. Norbert and I didn't understand it. One thing's sure, we mustn't tell Arthur Schulzberger. He certainly wouldn't understand it. Knowing we had a way over the Alps changed everything. We began to speak to one another again, and Norbert and I even went to the hotel for cups of coffee, but got only thin lukewarms made from a little chicory. The waitress demanded 6 American cigarettes for it. When we returned to the station, we discovered Bill sitting in the Pontiac on top of a flat car. He looked very silly, but I didn't mention it. I didn't want to push my luck too far. Norbert and I went with him. Soon an engine with a few passengers backed into the siding and coupled us on. Behind us were several other flat cars with other automobiles and trucks that had failed to make the pass. The engineer threw in the throttle and we were off. It was going to be fun. I could see exceedingly well the giant mountains that appeared up with their chest out and their heads back on the other side of St. Anton. A flat car had its points, I decided, but no sooner had I decided that than we went into a tunnel. Golly, I protested. To Ronald? How else do you think we're going to get through these mountains? Bill asked in a bored tone. The tunnel ride continued so long that we decided to turn on the lights of the car and have lunch. 2 more boxes of K-rations. By now, I wasn't nearly so fond of K-rations that I had been the first time I had them on the Greek-Bulgarian border. When we came out of the tunnel, the train trip was over. Quickly, we got back onto the road and sailed toward the Swiss border. Around the middle of the afternoon, we made it, and immediately we could see the difference between a country that had been through war and occupation and a country that had escaped everything. The Swiss fields were even better tended than the Austrian, which I hadn't thought possible. The grain was thicker and greener, the forest of firs more neatly trimmed, and the underbrush more thoroughly cleaned out. And the shop window showed the greatest contrast. The houses in Switzerland looked roomy and substantial and well cared for. There were no cracks in the stucco. There was no paint peeling away. The windows shine. The doorsteps gleam. The yards are spick and span. This is especially noticeable in the area predominantly populated by German-speaking Swiss. The store windows are full of all sorts of goods, too. We saw little difference between them and the store windows at home. There were dresses, suits, shoes, refrigerators, cameras, cigarette lighters, watches, clocks, everything. For the first time in many months, we were back to a land of plenty. About 4 o'clock, we were ravenously hungry. We hadn't had a real meal all day. We would stop briefly and have sandwiches and beer, Bill said. We found an inn bright with many pots of geraniums and primroses in the white curtained windows. Look, how sweet, I said. Remember, Bill barked, we came in just to eat, not to admire potted plants. Men always get cross when they are hungry and tired. This I well know, but somehow I can't remember it, particularly when men are hungry and tired. In halting German, Bill explained to the Swiss waitress that we wanted 3 sandwiches and 3 beers. She nodded and laughed. Sandwiches, she repeated. Yes, sandwiches. She giggled delightedly and went out. The 3 sandwiches were a huge pewter platter of slices of ham, corned beef, bologna, salami, and every other kind of cold meat you can think of, and slices of hard-boiled eggs, pickles, and lettuce, and a plate of rolls. There was enough for 10 people. For the rest of the afternoon, we rode happily along shadowed roads cut through forests and towering firs and sunny roads winding through mildly rolling valleys tucked in between the mountains like piecework quilts. It was all lovely, wonderful, beautiful, but I kept such a curb on my tongue, Bill gave me a check mark when we stopped for the night because I hadn't, quote, done so bad. and the next morning, riding from Bern to Geneva, I continued to merit his approval until I caught my first glimpse of Lake Geneva. That ruined everything. Oh, that I should have lived so long, Bill cried. Here you've blown up in the sixth inning without a man out. What do you mean with a man out? Demanded Norbert. You're right, agreed Bill, starting on a new track. She has struck two out. Why, you know, I couldn't be sold now even to the Bush League. Coming into Geneva, we passed a hospital, and in front of it hung a big sign with two words on it in three languages. Prudent, silence. As if we just had that sign, Norbert, when we started, exclaimed, gosh, what a difference it might have made. I, of course, am just as happy they didn't have it. I wouldn't have wanted any of it different.